Great to be back with you, John Cleary, on this Sunday night. And what a busy night we have for you. I spent 5 weeks getting ready for this. First up, in just a few moments' time, we're going to be meeting the Reverend Tim Costello and the Anglican Primate, Archbishop Dr. Philip Freer of Melbourne, where on Wednesday last, they met with a host of people, a full house at the Edge Theatre in Melbourne at Federation Square at 7:30 on Wednesday morning for a discussion about refugees and the Australian conscience. And in just a moment, we're going to be picking up those threads with Bishop Vincent Long of the Catholic Church. The Catholic bishops released a statement on Thursday calling on Australians to show more concern for refugees. Bishop Vincent, welcome to Sunday Nights. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on your program, John.
Bishop, why did the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference on Thursday find it necessary and important to call for an end to offshore detention?
Yes, John. Well, it's been a few years now that the asylum seekers have been kept in detention centres in Nauru and Manus Island. There are still over 1,000 asylum seekers, most of whom have their claims for refugee status determined as positive. And I must point out that among the 1,300 asylum seekers being detained in Nauru and Manus Island, there are still a high number of children who have been languishing in those detention centres. And the Australian bishops think that it is high time for Australia to take responsibility of these asylum seekers, these proven refugees, and bring them home to Australia so as to be able to attend to their needs in a way that is befitting their human dignity, John.
Bishop, the Catholic bishops tend to be very cautious in statements. They don't make definitive statements very often unless something is of serious concern. There's a sentence in the statement which I think is about as definitive as I've heard over recent years. Quote, "While recognising the effort of the government to find a solution, we say enough is enough. We call on the government to bring offshore detainees to Australia while waiting further decisions on their future." This will come as a shock to some politicians, I would imagine.
Well, the situation of the detainees in offshore detention centres is quite concerning, as we Australians know. The human cost on them are mounting by the day. The psychological harm due to the uncertainty and living conditions in those centres has resulted in incidents like self-harm and even attempted suicides. And therefore, we think that it is high time to resolve the situation. The boats have stopped, but we still make the asylum seekers in those centres the example of deterrence for future asylum seekers, and that is morally unacceptable. So we call on the government to resolve the situation quickly and bring them to Australia.
This reflects something of the sentiment expressed in a letter by the Reverend Tim Costello, who we'll be hearing from shortly, together with Father Frank Brennan and Robert Mann a few weeks ago, saying, look, the boats have stopped. We can now isolate that issue from the issue of the detainees, and they should be dealt with separately.
Exactly, John.
You're echoing a call by Pope Francis as well, because he, as I understand, has expressed concern on this issue.
He has indeed. I sat next to him at a dinner table in the Vatican just 2 weeks ago, John. I was there for a retreat, and at the end of it, I was invited to lunch with His Holiness. And I used the occasion to talk to him about the issue of asylum seekers in Australia, and specifically those on Nauru and Manus Island. And I also conveyed to him the letter that some of these asylum seekers wrote to him out of despair for their plight. And they asked him to use his influence to intervene. And the Pope clearly, visibly was concerned about their situation. And he in fact told me that he applauded the way Italy, which has dealt with the plight of refugees in a way that is far more humane than Australia. They don't turn the boats back. They don't make deterrence the policy of border protection. And he deplored the way we harshly deal with asylum seekers. And this gave me the impetus to voice our concern about the situation of the asylum seekers in those centres. John?
Bishop Vincent Long, it's been very good of you to spend time with us. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you, John, and thank you for your listeners.
Bishop Vincent Long, spokesperson for the Australian Catholics Bishops Conference, calling an end for offshore detention. You're on Sunday nights, and right now we're off to Melbourne, where on Wednesday the Reverend Tim Costello, long associated as the CEO for World Vision, and Archbishop Philip Freer, the Anglican Primate of Australia, joined me in a conversation at the Edge Theatre at Melbourne's Federation Square at 7:30 in the morning with a rather crowded house. Let's be off to Federation Square. Thank you very much. This morning, there's almost, I feel, very little need to introduce our topic. It's one of those that's on the forefront of the newspapers almost every day. I'm not sure how many of you were watching Q&A on Monday night, but the first part of the program provided something, I think, of a useful introduction to this morning's discussion. Retired Major General Jim Molan, a principal architect and a staunch defender of the sovereign borders regime, declared that the system, including boat turnbacks, indefinite detention and temporary protection visas, was, quote, the new normal for Australia, so we just need to get used to it. It was a statement that was almost guileless in its directness and honesty, said with the assurance of someone who felt he was not only enunciating good policy, but who had the solid backing of a rock-solid majority of Australians. Molan was not only reflecting current political reality. He had the assurance of reaching back through over 100 years of Australia's history, even to the days before Federation. In the 1890s, William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, visited Australia to attempt to convince governments and people to support a migration and training scheme for the poor of industrial England. He was opposed by both right and left. The left feared jobs would be taken. The right that the poor trash of England would disrupt the social values of emerging urban Australia. Booth departed the port of Fremantle in 1891 with these words: "It seems to me that the moment a man lands on these shores, he sticks up a placard and shouts, Australia for the Australians. A nation cannot be untrue to the great principles which have to do with human happiness and welfare any more than the individual. And selfishness, if it is hateful in the individual, must be deplorable in the nation." This is the same challenge we face 125 years on. Has Jim Moylan presented us with a new or very old normal? And what sort of a challenge does that present for those concerned with fundamental values? A good place to begin our discussion. Archbishop Philip Freer, fundamental values. In this context, what are they? What are the key values we need to hold on to, and is there a new normal in which those values can be relativised?
Well, I think that's the key place to start, because I think the fundamental values are about the dignity of human life, and much of the things that we see around us that we take for granted about our citizenship, our circumstances of birth, how we happen to be legally identified in the world, are really human constructs. And so when we have very vulnerable people who have none of the protections that those things offer, I think it does come down to the sense of our own empathy, our own identification of our common humanity as to how we want to perceive those people. So I think there is a core issue about the humanity of those people who are in these situations of immigration detention, people who are displaced and fleeing from violence throughout the world, but it also feeds back to what our humanity is. So I think that the fundamental value is about our humanity and the dignity we ascribe to it, and what we think that being a human, what are the inherent rights and the values that we think really come from and arise from that position of being. And I think we do relativise this. I mean, I think we've had a long period of time where there's this been use of illegals for people who come to Australia in some irregular way. And I think that when you normalise language like that, I mean, it's only language, but when you normalise language like that, it's not a big leap that then people might have some harsh punishment. If they've done something illegal, unlawful, harsh punishment seems to be, in many people's thinking, a natural development. So I think that we do see some examples of this relativising of human dignity and human worth just through some small things that probably on the way through people don't think are big turning points.
Tim Costello, Jim Molan seemed to be reaching with confidence to what he felt was a pragmatic, practical Australian view and almost a situational ethic. What was your response?
Yes, I'm just in from London, so if I don't make any sense to you, I'm probably not making any sense to myself. I didn't sleep a wink last night with jet lag, but I did have time because of that to actually eye view that Q&A. And the most striking thing that Jim Molan said was we should be enormously proud of Operation Border Security. It's a success. It's really our greatest achievement. And it left me going, why do I feel ashamed? Why do I actually feel ashamed? And I think why this issue is on our front pages and it's even packed at 7:30 in the morning is for so many of us, we know this is actually about us. It's actually about the self-image we've had of us as Australians that are generous and welcoming. And as you rightly said in your introduction, dealing with something that's almost a ghost demon in the DNA of white Australia policy, the first act of Parliament, of the federal Parliament when it was constituted, the Immigration Restriction Act. So the coloured people weren't allowed to come here. Those that were here, Kanakas, had to be expelled. And our Indigenous, of course, we just ignored and deprived of rights. A long history of saying we are blessed to be the only nation continent on earth, which made Malcolm Turnbull's boast that we have the best policies in the world at the UN just 3 weeks ago, without a trace of irony, the only nation continent in the world surrounded by sea. Everyone else has the misfortune of sharing land borders, and particularly where disasters are, having the far greater burden of refugees. And no irony that we're also blessed to have poor indigenous nation islands like Nauru that we can contract out our issues to. But that ghost within our system, within our DNA, I sort of knew as a child. My grandfather was English, my grandmother of Scottish descent, her mother was Scottish. And when I stayed with them and they threw open the blinds in the morning on a weekend and looked out the window, I knew from the longing in their eye, they just hoped they'd see London or Edinburgh, not Dili or Jakarta. And that sense that we're actually in the wrong place of the world and we're really white and we're really British and we're going to do everything to actually protect this, I think we are still working out. So for me, I feel profoundly ashamed. What you read, and I didn't know William Booth's comments, just struck a chord of saying, and this has actually been within coursing within our veins, this sort of virus, for a long time, and a paralysing debate, a toxic debate for 15 years that we've had here, I think has damaged the Australian soul. I don't believe we could have cut aid, as Tony Abbott did, by 30% that deals with refugees and climate change to our lowest level ever in our history, that without virtually a bleat. We couldn't have done that but for this toxic debate. If you can't have empathy for people arriving here who literally are in your face, no wonder we have no empathy in our aid program and can cut it beyond our shores to the lowest levels. So this is about me. I do feel ashamed. There's some solutions that I, with Robert Mann and Frank Brennan, have been working on, but I feel very different to Jim Molan. Very, very different.
Archbishop, as a churchman, you have spent much of your life working through a period in which you have seen these attitudes change. If we go back to the solution of the Fraser years, to the Vietnam boat refugee issue, where there was a bipartisan support policy, what for you has changed in the psyche of Australia, and where do you mark it? You've been tracking these changes yourself and seen them and worked with them over the years.
Well, I think the biggest change you can see is through leadership, because I think that the leaders of these earlier eras showed great empathy and concern for people. I remember Bob Hawke, when the tragedy at Tiananmen Square was revealed, and there are many Chinese students in Australia, you know, the emotion that he had of how this was a tragedy that we couldn't be distant from, that we had a responsibility to give hospitality to people who were students here and perhaps would, if they went back there, would be looked on with suspicion and suffer harm. And so I think that when you had leadership in our country, political leadership, that was experiencing this empathy and acting out of this common value of a shared humanity, I think people were, that they felt that framed any insecurities of the kind that Tim's mentioned. I think it helped frame those and give them some confidence that these were constructive and positive things to do. But I think we've had a swing, and it probably, you know, it can go back, you could maybe tamper as the turning point, but you have a swing around to our political leaders being proud about a harsh position and being resolved about a harsh position. And there's a famous speech of John Howard's where he, you know, said very defiantly, you know, we will determine who comes to Australia and under what conditions they come. And I think that was something of a turning point of leaders feeling able to voice in a very resolute way a harsh position, and I think that's continued. So it does take, I think, some courage of political leaders to reframe that thinking, because I think the current situation of people being in indefinite detention is a morally untenable situation. And we can see from Obama's desire to shut Guantanamo Bay down, which he's failed to do in two terms of his presidency, that there's, you know, there's some real inertia that you've got to confront when you want to actually change things structurally. So I think it'll take real courage from political leaders to confront this issue and have a different view.
I want to get to some of the specifics shortly, but just picking up, you reference Obama, because a number of commentators are saying, look, you cannot see this issue in isolation as just an Australian issue now. We are caught in a global reality. The global reality of failed foreign policy in the Middle East over the last decade and a half, and what's happening in Europe. We see the Brexit phenomenon in the UK, and the Trump phenomenon perhaps peaking in the United States over the last few days, where people genuinely feel left behind. And those people being left behind are the same people who felt left behind when this debate has manifested itself previously in our societies. But now we're seeing it global, and it's in our living rooms every day. The reality that we face is a global reality that is not simply identifiable and locatable in Australia. Is there a wider issue here, Tim, that has to be addressed, that goes to something of the broader context that World Vision has been consistently involved in?
There's no question that the world is re-tribalising. And the profound drive for re-tribalising is identity. Left and right in politics both have a truth. And as a person who's a moderate, I often am sandwiched because I can see the truth of the right, which is actually around identity, secure borders, protection of who we are. It's sort of committed at the core, identity ideas. The left has a truth which is about being open at the edges, saying we're all human, and human rights are universal. And what we're seeing is particularly driven by globalisation, which overall does lift growth, but does it so unevenly with a massive blowout of inequality. So we want, and the right plays to us on this, we want cheaper cars, we want cheaper digital TV screens, but actually that means they're not going to be made here in Australia or in America, The blue-collar workers who are supporting Trump. They're going to be made elsewhere, and there's losers. So the re-tribalising that you see with the Brexit and the Trump phenomenon, and I guess with Trump we can be at least thankful in Australia we haven't quite got to the gutter politics of what's going on there. I did see a little bit of that debate, and you know, Trump seemed to be saying, yes, I sexually abuse and assault women, but I'm not as bad as Bill Clinton, and that's his defence. And that's sort of the level of where politics has gone to. The re-tribalising is what World Vision actually sees as being the great challenge for our world, because we know with globalisation our future is interdependent. The world is a waterbed. You press down here, it comes up here. Refugees, terror are just one example. Global banking, financial waves that run across us, climate change, global diseases. You know, swine flu broke out in Mexico in 2008. We're closing primary schools in inner Melbourne. Mm-hmm. We're in a profoundly interdependent world. And what Obama is really saying is, and Angela Merkel too, we actually do not have in the Refugee Convention, never have had, a mechanism for sharing the responsibility together. So the EU puts up one, and Orbán in Hungary runs a whole referendum to say we're not taking even 1,380 refugees. So few in Hungary. Now, thankfully, not enough people went out to vote, and he was defeated. But those forces are really powerful. The answer to globalisation, of course, is proper safety nets, proper investment in skills and retraining, which we haven't invested in most nations to actually deal with that hurt and that pain. The re-tribalising, I really say, is the old gods coming back. They're the gods of blood, which is what racism is about, The gods of soil, which is what nationalism is about. And as a Christian, I've always said worship of those old gods leads to some really nasty treatment of people, which I think is what our asylum seeker debate is about.
Archbishop, your reflection on that global context.
Oh, I think it's very true. I think we are in an increasingly globalised society, and this is one of the questions we confront about inequality in the world, about the vision that people, even in the what might be the most remote and the least economically advanced parts of the world, have people living in places now who once would never have imagined perhaps even moving beyond the valley that they live in to the next valley, now have much more of a global vision of where possibility exists. And so I think that we only have to understand that human motivation to a fairly simple extent, that once people's horizons widen and there is something adverse in their situation economically, if there is a situation of conflict or war, there are situations of their own culture they find oppressive, people with now a global vision will look like any of us would look to a different context where they can be more prosperous, they can be safer, their future can be more assured. So I think that we've got, you know, at the most fundamental human dimension, a whole blowout of vision across everyone across the planet.
And the problem with that is it seems to reinforce the Jim Molan view of the world. I mean, can there be such a thing in this context as a consistent Christian response? I mean, are there gospel universals that cannot be traded away? Even our former Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, a professing Christian, former seminarian, stated in Britain at last year's Margaret Thatcher lecture, quote, "The imperative to love your neighbour as yourself is at the heart of every Western polity. But right now, this wholesome instinct is leading much of Europe, parenthesis Australia, into catastrophic error." Tony Abbott is suggesting that a simplistic application of a general injunction is not always productive. Is that not a reasonable proposition?
Well, it's a trouble. Things may be reasonable, but they still might be wrong. I think there's often inherent reason in something. You can start here and by logic get to there, but that doesn't demonstrate that it's a right position to hold. And I think that, you know, someone who would say that this is a foundational value or a foundational perspective, but it can kind of somehow be parked. And I think that's the difficulty we've got. You know, we have this sort of language in which, George Bush Jr. brought in about a war on terror. You start using the language of exceptional circumstances, and we know in war there are a whole lot of things about human rights that are often at risk or violated. So you start getting this sort of thing. Are we living in such an exceptional time that foundational things that we might all agree to are right have to be somehow parked or not examined? And I think that's if we get to that place in this context of the people movements around the world, I think that's a very dangerous place for us to be in.
Tim.
Yeah, it was interesting. That was the Margaret Thatcher lecture he gave. And Margaret Thatcher famously reflected on the Good Samaritan also. And she said, the point of the Good Samaritan is that the Good Samaritan had money in his pocket and he was able to help the Jewish person beat up on the road. So the principle is be self-sufficient and economically prosperous. So you can draw a whole lot of things from the Good Samaritan. I think Tony Abbott can actually mount a political argument that the nation state's first duty, and this is why it has coercive powers, is to protect its own and to protect its borders. And in the solution that we've been working on, we've said let's acknowledge that turn back of boats, protecting borders, is working, and we can actually settle people from Manus and Nauru without having temporary protection visas and saying they must never, ever come here to Australia. But I don't think Tony Abbott can actually, as a Christian, say this is the point of the Good Samaritan. In fact, the point of the Good Samaritan, in my view, is that Jesus says this Jewish man beat up on the road was stripped of his clothing. It's a little detail we miss. I'm sure the priest, if he could have told from his clothing and identification he was a fellow Jew, would have felt an immediate ethic of responsibility, likewise the Levite. But they couldn't tell. And so there wasn't any direct responsibility in religious cultural terms. Neither, of course, could the Samaritan tell if he was one of his mob. The point is the Samaritan saw a human. He saw a human. And I think that's the point Jesus was making. And human rights, we have to remember, were meant to trump national rights. That's the actual point of human rights being universal and beyond simply national rights that say us first and our protection first. Human rights are always contested and honoured in the breach much more than in performance because national rights keep trumping them. But as a Christian, I think Tony Abbott got the message wrong in the Thatcher lecture, but he has a respectable political argument if he just said this is a political argument, not a Christian ethic.
Before we go to responses, one other quote from Tony Abbott's lecture, which I think touches on another visceral issue. Quote, "The Australian experience proves that the only way to dissuade people seeking to come from afar is not to let them in. It will require some force. It will require massive logistics and expense. It will gnaw out our consciences," he said. "Yet it is the only way to prevent a tide of humanity surging through Europe and quite possibly changing it forever." Tony Abbott there is saying, by default, through profound policy failure in the Middle East, the West and its values are being overwhelmed by a refugee crisis that is civilizational in its implications. It picks up on the Huntington thesis, the clash of civilizations. It echoes through those older discussions we had earlier. It's suggesting that cultures not accustomed to the rule of law in the Western democratic tradition will swamp the system before the system has time to absorb those cultures into its value system. It's an existential crisis. We have to make existentially urgent decisions. And like all decisions, be they war in other circumstances, the greater good has to prevail. And this greater good is a civilizational one. And that's what's underpinning much of this debate, albeit unspoken. Archbishop, first, is there a sense in which Christian civilization is at issue?
Well, I think the way you put it does sound very dramatic. But I think that equally, all of the societies we're speaking about are very welcoming to people if they have wealth. They're welcoming to people if they have skills that are desired. And I think that Australia welcomes many people. We have, and we only have to look probably at some of the investment in Melbourne. We welcome people, we welcome their money, we welcome those who... And we don't examine the ethical basis upon which people gain their money. I mean, there's all sorts of Russian oligarchs living in very fine suburbs of London, and no one's given them much of an ethical test about how they came by their great wealth, but they've been welcome because they're wealthy. And I think that, so we're not talking about hermetically sealed societies. We are talking about societies that welcome many people. Australia has, very significant migration into this country. But we are talking about some people at the edge of it who don't have wealth, who have perhaps they've had some motivation, but they have come through. They are in a situation of some exceptionalism that they haven't been able to come through the normal channels. So we're talking. I think that if the proposition you're putting is correct, it is as correct with economic migration and skilled migration as it is with people who are refugees or people fleeing from difficult circumstances. So I think that whilst it's dramatic as you tell the story, and I'm sure there are more articulate people in the public sphere who would argue those things, I don't think it's an argument.
Mm. Tim?
Yeah, it's absolutely the case that Australians and the West are fearing Islamic terrorism, and their Muslims are all terrorists is a huge jump. That actually narrative plays exactly to ISIS and al-Qaeda. And even though the Andrew Bolts and others hate hearing me or anyone say this, there is no doubt in my mind that when we decided to go to war in Iraq, the message in the Muslim world was Christian West is bombing us without real reason, and they hate us. And we know into the vacuum ISIS grew, and we know that the theological disputes going on, particularly between Sunni and Shia, excite apocalyptic passions that do leave societies in ruin. We know that these are real issues that we have to discuss. To the question, can Muslims really integrate here? Absolutely. And most Muslims, if you get to know most Muslims, are extraordinarily keen to integrate. I remember doing an interfaith event a few months ago with a Muslim woman who said, "My religion is in the Dark Ages." She was wearing a hijab, and she very courageously said, "As a Syrian, I learnt at the feet of great men and women imams in Syria, the Quran. She said, I've come here and I've seen we've taken out of my religion two things, spirituality and women. And she spoke very courageously. Now, there's a lot of those Muslim voices with this struggle going on. Yet, when we do the caricaturing of they're all terrorists playing into ISIS hands, I had a very interesting experience, actually, with Malcolm Fraser up in Indonesia. And when you go to the Vietnamese experience, the difference with the Vietnamese experience and welcoming 60,000 was bipartisanship. It was Malcolm Fraser and Labor actually agreeing. And that experience was very similar to what's going on here. No governments would let Vietnamese boats land. In fact, World Vision bought a boat, Sea Sweep, and started picking up people who were drowning in the sea, shaming governments in Malaysia, Hong Kong, Australia and Canada to say, these people are dying. Mm. And we actually got together a resettlement program and now we celebrate it. Malcolm Fraser, who led that then, was with me in Indonesia. Megawati Putri Sukarni was president. The first Gulf War was about to begin. And she said to both of us, is it true that George W. Bush, Tony Blair and John Howard are committed Christians? And Malcolm Fraser turned to me and said, this one's for you, Tim. And I said, well, yes, I think all three men have a Christian faith. And then she said, and is it true that for a Christian, even if they're a politician, their faith is the most important thing driving their decision-making? Now I was really worried. I said, well, in theory, I think that's probably right. So, she said, it must be their faith leading them to the decision to go to war. Now, I said, no. Actually, churches have stood against this war, and no, that's a political decision. But I got an insight into just how deep-set this view now is, that when we decided the Christian West to go and bomb, we set the cement with something that's really profound, and we actually have to break up that cement and not be stampeded into, no, they can never integrate, they're all terrorists.
We've spent some time painting a picture of the way the world is. Groups like World Vision are concerned with solutions. I want to talk now about some of the approaches that can be used given the difficulties we confront. And it seems to me the difficulties are in three areas. One, stopping the boats. Two, indefinite detention. And three, temporary protection visas. All of these things bear on policy. Archbishop, you have emblazoned across your cathedral, and you've had it for some years, to fully welcome refugees. What is meant by the word fully? And in the face of the reality exposed by people like Jim Molan, and we've discussed this morning, is not a statement like that something of a futile gesture?
Well, no, I think it isn't. When we've just been up there a while now, and when that was first put up, we certainly had members of our church who'd come from Sudan, South Sudan, as refugees, who'd been in Australia, you know, now 15 years, some longer. And they said, that's wonderful. They said, because, you know, all the time we've been here, we've had resettlement programs, a whole lot of things, but we don't really feel we've been fully welcomed. We sort of feel we've been tolerated, been given a place, we don't feel fully welcomed. So I think that was a very big learning experience for me, to learn what you know, our own, in our church context, members of our church, people who've come from refugee background, took that to be a great affirmation and a corrective to what they thought was otherwise a sort of, you know, you might be accepted to 80%, but you're never really 100% part of the community. So I think that, I'll give you an example. We just hosted a fortnight ago an event which was about some fundraising for a sewing program for refugee women. And just to see, you know, this is a very grassroots thing, happens in a local parish out in Box Hill, but just to see the way that people who are people probably mostly like people here this morning were spending their time, their skills, their energy, giving some pathways of learning for refugee women, how those refugee women, and they are from a range of places, from Africa, from Afghanistan, from Iraq and from Sri Lanka, just to see how, you know, their confidence of being part of the Australian community was really enhanced by that. And I think that was, to me, you know, a grassroots example of fully welcoming refugees, understanding their desires to be part of the community, grassroots action that gave them some pathways into that and some opportunities of flourishing. And it's wonderful to see.
And the benefits you're suggesting flow both ways. They flow to the refugees, but they also flow into the Australian community through Australians getting more comfortable with who these
very rich experience for everyone, a very mutual experience that broke down barriers and stereotypes, and people see each other as people who can do something with each other and share time productively and enjoyably together.
There are many good examples, and World Vision has them too, of the way we welcome and should be able to welcome refugees into our communities. And many local congregations are perhaps the best examples of how to do that, because groups of people gathering together can provide that basis. There is another issue or another set of problems we're facing, and that is at the political level. Tim, with World Vision, you've had to address how we come together to address the politics of the problem. You were the co-signatory of a letter, along with Father Frank Brennan and Robert Mann, as you mentioned, of a recent letter suggesting that one way through the problem was to break the nexus between stopping the boats and indefinite detention. Stopping the boats works as a policy, therefore there's no need for the inhumanity of indefinite detention. You see this as a compromise and a legitimate and necessary compromise. Others see it as a sellout. They say, no, you're ignoring the fact that people in need are still trying to get to Australia and you're facilitating the prevention of that.
Yeah. So this compromise is a pragmatic, I guess you'd say, rather than just a principled position. On principle, turning boats back and not knowing what actually happens to them does worry all of us. We are assured it's safe by Jim Moylan, but we aren't really allowed to know because it's so secretive. Mm. We're assured it's legal, but we're not really sure it actually is. But what we do know is that opinion polls overwhelmingly haven't moved. In fact, they've hardened against refugees coming in. And a democracy, the only way you have to resolve issues in a democracy is by majorities. Behind the ancient idea of a majority on the floor of the House is the idea of we are the biggest force, so it's better to settle this with a vote than go to battle. And here we have a majority of Australians saying borders and arrivals that aren't regulated, we will never accept. And that position has become intractable. It's why both major parties are locked in. So for the 1,750 souls on Manus and Nauru, we've said, OK, the pillars of border security have been, firstly, turn back, secondly, temporary protection visas. No one can argue temporary protection visas are fully welcoming refugees. It leaves them in a state of permanent insecurity and psychological distress. But that's the second pillar. The third is offshore processing. And we've said John Howard demonstrated that turn back actually did stop the boats. It took off the table the candy for the people smugglers. And he was able to resettle those on the Pacific Islands to Australia, New Zealand, elsewhere, without the boats all starting again. So this cataclysmic picture that we're told that if one person from Manus or Nauru is resettled here, they all start again, we believe, is hyperbole, it's exaggeration, it's fear, it's not actually what proven experience with John Howard showed. So as a way through, we've said refugees who have arrived in Indonesia or Malaysia, by definition, are out of harm's way of persecution. And Therefore, if there can be regional processing properly set up with Malaysia, Indonesia, and safe and legal means of arrival, with turnback still happening, there is no reason that Manus and Nauru should be warehousing people who we all now know is just practicing psychological torture. That's what it is. Every single report from Amnesty on has said this is absolutely damaging. So that's the pragmatic solution we've come up to test and to see if we can find a way through.
It raises a number of threshold issues for those who are concerned with the big question of the UN's Convention on Refugees. That is, those people coming in are not illegal. Your solution seems to tacitly accept the construction that these people are illegal. That is, they have no right to come here, and the boats are a sufficient deterrent.
So I think most of us, well, let me not make an assumption. I changed, the moral calculus for this position for me changed with 1,200 people drowning. By the way, I think there are crocodile tears often cried by people over drowning. They didn't seem to necessarily have too much conscience, you know, in having harsh policies before people drowning. But for me, the moral calculus changed. People getting on leaky boats and paying huge sums changed that moral calculus. That's why I believe offshore processing, safe and legal ways of coming here isn't conceding that they're illegals. It's saying, for your safety's sake, let's try it this way. Mind you, this doesn't apply if people, let's say civil war erupts in Papua New Guinea. There's about 3 kilometres stretch between Australia and Papua New Guinea. We then are the nearest place. If they started coming in boats here, I would say there is no justification for turn back. We get a leave pass because we're geographically at the bottom of the world, not adjoining any yet troubled places where people flee from. If it was Indonesia where civil war or disaster broke out and persecution was seeing floods coming here, I'd say, again, no turn back, because they are actually seeking the nearest place for safety and haven. But given that they aren't being persecuted in Indonesia, Malaysia, and we can do a safe way with offshore processing, with turn back still in place, I don't think it concedes that I'm saying they're illegal.
Archbishop Phillip, are you in any way troubled by the suggestion that Tim and Frank Brennan and Robert Mann have put forward?
No, look, I've always had the view that I think it is one of the responsibilities of national governments to be concerned about the management of borders. And you know, we experience that any time we go anywhere, we encounter the apparatus of government in doing that. But I think, you know, what happens needs to be humane, and it needs not to put people in peril. But I'd go along with that proposition. But I think that the idea of people being kept in indefinite detention as a foundational pillar of a policy about these matters is flawed. And I don't think that we should agree that we have to keep people on Nauru or on Manus Island because we're being told that they need to be in this situation for some sort of exemplary purpose to send a signal. And I think that's a false notion. But throughout the whole Judeo-Christian tradition, there is always this kind of time, of whether it's a time of Sabbath, a time of Jubilee, but a time when you know you actually try and dial things back to a normal situation. You don't keep things as they are forever. And I think that we should be very open to the to saying, well, look, you know, this is an anomaly that has existed. All the evidence is it's not good for the people concerned. Let us, out of our common humanity, correct that and bring people from Nauru and from Manus Island. Because clearly the early rhetoric, the Papua New Guinean government is in no way going to welcome people to find their permanent residence there. Nauru is a tiny place, and no one, you know, it's a community of 10,000 people. It's got no capacity. So Australia has every capacity. The organisations responsible for the resettlement of refugees could readily manage the resettlement of people in Manus and Nauru to Australia. I think they're very traumatised, and I think we'd have to invest significant money because they are people probably far more traumatised now than when they first arrived and were sent there.
So we do seem to be saying we can, to some extent, relativise our ethical position here. That is, we're prepared to work towards the resolution of an outstanding ethical matter on the issue of indefinite detention by leaving aside the problems that the rest of the world is grappling with a mass flow of peoples across the globe.
No, I and my colleagues would add a couple of extra things, that Australia, whose international reputation, and I travel internationally, has really been trashed through our policies. It's embarrassing. When my colleagues elsewhere say, we didn't think Aussies were like this. I think Australia can retrieve some of its trash reputation by leading a renewal of the Refugee Convention. The difficulty with the Refugee Convention 1951 was it has no reporting mechanisms, it doesn't have the full bolstering of the Human Rights Acts that came in after it, and it was devised for people who are largely fleeing political or religious persecution. Most people fleeing are fleeing civil war, they're fleeing humanitarian disasters, and the lead Australia should give is actually coming up with a mechanism for responsibility sharing, for saying, of the 60 million displaced people in the world, of whom about 2 million will actually be refugees. Most people who are displaced just want to go back home. You know, World Vision's in Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey. We're in the camps. I can tell you those Syrians just want to go back home. Why are a million going to Europe? Because they've lost hope that the war will ever end. And because of aid cuts, the food vouchers in the camps were reduced from $30 a month to $13.50 a month. Try and survive on 42 cents a day. This is the cut of aid that then actually said to desperate people, the war's not going to end, they've lost hope. We can't keep our families alive here. And they started in masses going toward Europe. So proper funding, proper mechanisms for responsibility sharing. Australia's part of that is increasing our refugee intake to at least 30,000. When Malcolm announced generously in the pay-to-play Obama conference, we'll lift it from 13,500 to 18,500, the quota for humanitarian refugees. That's still lower than what Labor had. It was 20,000 under Labor, slashed to 13,500. We're not sharing our responsibility, and we're wanting applause for not even lifting it back to where it was. So we would add those things, which isn't therefore relativising human rights.
It brings us back then to what we can do finally. Two levels. One, you're suggesting we need to advocate and lobby with our governments to increase aid, which goes to source areas of problem. That's an activity that church organisations and others are involved in. There's also grassroots activity. Archbishop, you've alluded to one, that is people being friendly, being neighbourly. The other is actions by church groups that have re-engaged with what could be seen as 1960s civil disobedience on behalf of refugees. One thinks of groups like Love Makes a Way, in which there are a number of Anglicans, Baptists and others involved. What's your view of that sort of activity on behalf of, initially it was children in detention in Manus, of occupations, of breaking the law in order to foster a greater good? Perhaps not even breaking the law, but creating civil disturbance for the sake of the greater good.
Well, I think we might have some people this morning who will speak who come from groups that have organised themselves as community-based groups to have a voice in this. And I think that it's about this extreme secrecy, it's about the lack of transparency, so that ordinary people only get glimpses of what's happening on some of these places where we're keeping people in detention. So, and I really would want to go back to your earlier point about are we relativising things, because I think that we're able to act in what is our clear sphere of control. And I think that for many, many people here in Australia, the things that we can do are fairly limited, because intentionally with all these policies, the people that we're concerned about are kept far outside of even our position to befriend them, to talk to them, to engage them, to understand their circumstances. So that the things that we can do here are fairly limited. There have been various initiatives. I know some people have been involved at sit-ins in politicians' offices and in other things. But I think that those things don't seem to have persuaded political leaders to have a different view. I think we really need to act in those things we can control and put pressure that people who are kept in detention on Manus Island and in Nauru at the control of the Australian government in our name, that those people, their situation of detention ends and a better future is given to them. And I think that we should all be part of engaging in activism for that purpose.
Tim, what's your view on the whole sort of renewal of the civil disobedience approach?
Yeah, I support it. I'm a Baptist. We've always fought against the state church, Philip. I believe that the role of the church is actually to keep alive the image of God in everyone. And when people seek asylum, asylos, the word, actually means sacred, inviolable. To seek asylum, which is a biblical notion, the cities of asylum, is to say there's something inviolable, sacred, about every human. And the church's particular role is to keep that alive. And where the state is violating people seeking asylum, they've committed no crime, they're simply seeking asylum from persecution and disaster, and we lock them up. 90% have been found to be refugees on Manus and Nauru, and they're locked up with this indefinite detention to send a message, using people as means to an end, to send a message. That's a fundamental violation of the image of God in them. And when churches, sanctuary movement and others say, no, 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 we are going to reassert that sacred, inviolable part of humanity, the image of God, and it's called civil disobedience, I think that's quite appropriate. Now, there should be parameters, there should be full willingness to take the penalty from the law, because you know you're breaking it, but from Gandhi to Mandela to Martin Luther King, who now all are heroes, they were hated and treated with great contempt for being lawbreakers, and now they're people who we say morally, they got it right. Keeping that alive is incredibly important.
Well, I think that's the point at which perhaps we could take a few questions from the audience, if there is time to do that.
Ray Cleary from the Anglican Church. The Economist magazine and other commentators have recently indicated that governments now increasingly have no control over the impacts of globalisation, the movement of wealth, the movement of goods and services, taxation are a few examples of that. Therefore, asylum seekers and refugees is one area that governments have embraced to show that they're in charge, that they have authority. My question is, if this is true, what does it say about the future of democratic governments, and what does it say about the sorts of examples, including civil disobedience, of the people?
Thank you very much. We might just take a couple of questions and then hand them over to the panel. Are there another one just on? Yeah.
Thanks very much. Leonie Bird, Holy Trinity Q. I am concerned that there has been silence from all three of you about the breaches of UN conventions that our migration policy clearly functions under. There is a breach of the Human Rights Declaration on Children's Rights, the UN Convention on Political Rights, the UN Convention on Citizens' Rights to Humanity, but also, more importantly, we are functioning as a breach of the UN rights of the refugees. That's a hard-hearted, legal, tough proposition. I'm putting it to you that our function of our Migration Act is in fact undermining the rule of law itself. And can you tell me why there is a reluctance to enunciate those breaches of human conventions?
Thank you. And just one more in the front here.
Margaret Young, this is not a question, it's a comment, and it does follow on from that previous question. Tim, in a recent interview, I heard you quoting Wilberforce as one of your heroes, and I think the quote went along the lines of, if we see something evil and turn away, we still remember that we saw it. It doesn't give us any wriggle room, does it?
Mm.
Thank you.
So thank you. So one question on control exercised by governments and on the UN conventions, and then the comment on William Wilberforce.
Yeah, I think what Ray said is correct. The governments have a far less sense of control over many aspects of life, and in the more complex world, we've known that governments have relatively little control over the pledge of economic prosperity they make to people. So I think it's probably easy to find an area where you can exercise control and show that you're in control. And so I can sort of see some of these areas of popularists that gain popularist support are fairly relevant for governments to appear in control of things, because many other aspects of life are not particularly amenable to their control. And I think that's the new reality we're facing. So I think that this kind of investment of confidence, which we've most of us here have grown up with, that government is something which is inherently able to manage many aspects of life, is an assumption that probably is questionable now. But I think that doesn't justify finding an area with vulnerable people where we exercise control in the exemplary in a harsh way.
Mm. Yeah, I think Ray and Leone's point really goes to the same issue, and that is, we do not have an international mechanism for sanctioning and enforcement of human rights and their abuses, because it's only national governments that have that coercive power. And this is the great disconnect. We need some global governance mechanisms, not government, governance mechanisms with sanctions when there are breaches of conventions. There's the International Criminal Court, but the reality is only small African dictators will be picked up by a NATO helicopter and dropped in The Hague and tried. Putin won't, for what has happened in Crimea or what he's doing in Syria, because he's too powerful. The Americans won't sign up to the ICC, the International Criminal Court. So this reality that we are living in a globalised world but have no globalised sanction mechanisms to sanction and enforce what we've signed up to is a profound challenge that we haven't solved. The truth is that when we take 200,000 permanent immigrants every year, there is, within our capacity and most Western nations' capacity, ample room to settle the asylum-seeking refugee situation. We're just choosing not to. We just cherry-pick from poor countries, their doctors, their lawyers. They've paid for them because it's good for our economic prosperity. It's beggar your neighbour rather than actually saying, let's be proactive, recognise this responsibility, have a mechanism that recognises it, and have global governance around it. That's what we need. The free movement of money, and there's some world trade rules and some arbitration disputes, the free movement of ideas, will one day require the free movement of people. But national sovereignty and pulling that lever of borders means we haven't got there yet. On the Wilberforce quote, Wilberforce made that quote when he introduced the Abolition for Slavery Bill. He said, you may look away, but you can't ever pretend you do not know now the evil of this. You do not know, you do not realise, you can't pretend you do not realise the evil of this. And of course, what was so courageous about Wilberforce was slavery was to the British Empire what iron ore and coal was to Australia. economically almost unassailable, and that was the moral imagination of Wilberforce.
But John, I think there's also something in the way this whole journey in our country, we've used our laws to construct various fictions. I mean, early on we excised parts of Northern Australia from being part of Australia for the purpose of the Immigration Act. So if you landed on the Kimberley coast, under the way we constructed things, it was as if you were landing in a place that wasn't Australia. We've constructed, you know, the concepts of temporary protection visas. So whilst you're here, and as most of us think, if you're living in society, you should enjoy the rights and responsibilities of being part of the society. Well, no, not really. You're sort of not really part of that. We've constructed these fictions. Well, these people on Manus or on Nauru, they're not really our responsibility. They're responsibility of the Nauruan government or the Papua New Guinean government. So I think that, you know, through this whole fictionalising of things, we're actually using our national identity, our national sovereignty, to do something which is quite destructive, because we're chewing away at identity and purpose.
But both of you are suggesting, by implication, that if we can absorb through normal processes something like 800,000 a year, 600,000 to 800,000 a year, that what really is going on here is a debate over crude political advantage. That is, that reservoir of feeling in the Australian people is being manipulated for crude political purposes about who can win power in government.
If we can get bipartisanship, 800,000 is people who come on visas for business and other things. 200,000 is people who come and permanently settle. And we're being magnificently generous with increasing it to 18,000 for asylum seekers. In other words, the capacity to do more, to share more, and to lead with our example to get a sharing mechanism, which is really what Merkel's been trying to get Europe to do. Merkel's interesting, you know, she's the daughter of a Lutheran pastor who was in West Berlin, and when the wall went up, her father, to identify with the suffering of the people in the East under communists, moved his whole family to the East, and Angela Merkel grew up in the East. And I often looked at Angela Merkel as, you know, a hardline conservative. It's been interesting that the pastor's daughter's heart has come out with the migration issue. And she's been magnificent, but she's getting carved up now by those ultra-right. You know, failure to settle Syria, if I can go to this, the war couldn't have gone on for more than a year without the funding of weapons and money from Iran and Saudi Arabia, who are both vying for control of the Middle East, and their backers, Russia and the West, America, and us backing Saudi Arabia, the Russians backing Iran. The failure to settle Syria is actually changing the geopolitics of Europe. This is profound failure of the great powers in terms of the ripple effect.
A couple more questions.
Bruce McKenzie's my name. Some 3 years ago, I sat in the same venue, and one of the speakers was Julian Burnside. And at that occasion, he puts forward some interesting, I thought, constructive proposals about the same or solving this issue or helping to solve the issue. And however, as has been said this morning, there's been no real change. In fact, it might have hardened up. I'm interested to hear that the focus has been on Nauru and also on Manus. But, you know, there are people at Broadmeadows and other detention centres in Australia who've been there for as long as I've been visiting. That goes back 3 years or more. I just wonder, I mean, whilst we're losing sight of the people who are in the detention centres in Australia and Christmas Island and focusing on, and as much as we should, on Manus and also Nauru, and I'd like to think that the attention could also be directed for those people who I see on a regular basis at Broadmeadows and other places.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie Power. Thank you very much for the discussion that we've had this morning. I think it's really valuable that we keep publicising and making public and sharing the information about this awful, awful situation that the government is doing to these people. So we really appreciate such articulate information. Thank you. I sort of wanted to bring forward some sort of small practical things that I think you brought forward. It is really important to meet these people, to spend time with these people. I mean, people are frightened, you know, the Muslim idea that's been brought forward as something that's terrifying. Come and work with them at the River Nile Learning Centre, where we teach Muslims, which are African young women who are mothers, English. Now, they're from Somalia. I mean, they've had no education. We had to teach them how to hold a pencil, how to thread a needle, how to use a ruler. You can work with these people. It's really good fun. There's a great need for people to come and work with them in teaching them English. They really want to learn. They're really enthusiastic. They're really keen. I've set up a textile program that you were mentioning was happening elsewhere, where we're teaching them to kind of make practical things for their kids and for their families and that. They just love it. So I think it's actually being involved personally with the refugees makes you more comfortable with them, and you can actually share this knowledge with others. The other thing I want to mention, Julian Burnside has mentioned, you actually can contact the people on Manus Island and Nauru. You can write to them. You can email them. You can actually talk to them. So I think that has been a fabulous opportunity for them to feel that there is support here for them in Australia. I also feel that maybe the churches obviously can do a huge amount in regard to supporting the refugees, and I would like to see more of that as well. But thank you for the opportunity to have this discussion today. It's very valuable.
Thank you very much. So if we pass those questions and comments back to the panel about onshore detention and about relationships with people who have come to this country.
Yes, it opens up the question of TPVs too, with temporary protection visas is a lovely euphemism, isn't it? But it actually disguises, as the Archbishop has said, a way of people not being allowed to be us, even though the government is saying, well, you're sort of pseudo-us. And in some ways, it can be a worse form of imprisonment because it's almost tangible, yet not so. Comments on that?
Yeah, I think the powerful human insight is that when you get to know someone, you change your categories, your ideology, your views. This works in all areas of life. You know, we've all been thinking about overnight the plebiscite and gay marriage, and I'm yet to meet someone who doesn't have a gay member of the family who doesn't change their view. It's really interesting. My dear old dad, wonderful man who died 5 months ago at 97, he always said he'd never met a gay person. And part of the reason for that was they were in the closet, literally, and it wasn't open and it wasn't discussed. And the attitude's changing is because people have come out and we've got to know them and their struggle. It's exactly the same with refugees, with Muslims. When you get to know people, it profoundly changes your attitudes. It's why the secrecy of what goes on Manus and Nauru, or even in our detention centres, has to be blown with people meeting, telling the story, saying, I once thought like this. What was the video take? Mary to Muhammad. Wonderful video in Hobart of a woman who hated Muslims and refugees until she met some. And her whole categories changed, and she was a classic example of this, what's really a gospel insight, that we are made for relationship. We are made for relationship, and ideology and categories then explode.
You know, I think that in Australian society, like most Western societies, we have become uncomfortable and unfamiliar with the contesting of religious ideas. I was just seeing in the newspaper yesterday, there was a comment about Eric Abetz, and he's supporting a group, I forget who, but they, amongst other things, they're talking about converting Muslims to Christianity. And that was being, in the Age, you know, almost reported as an awful thing. Why would anyone do that? Because in Australian society, we don't really welcome the contest of religious ideas. we don't know, really know how to handle religion, so we sort of want to either venerate or despise it. And I think that there's a sort of a, you know, often a despising of publicly of Christianity, and sometimes a venerating of any other religion we don't really know about. And people who don't profess religion are often offended that religious people might feel passionately about their faith and seek to persuade others to share it. And so I think that there's you know, in this whole area, there is we're seeing the discomfort about people who come from any perspective, who passionately hold to their beliefs and might seek to be persuasive about it. But I think that it's in the inner society like ours, which is about the free expression and the free exchange of ideas, that we should be most comfortable. We should learn to be more comfortable about the contesting of ideas about religious truth and religious value and religious identity. And we often have reasonably structured and formal things that governments try and get involved in. They try and, probably Tim and I have been involved in some of these things about interfaith dialogue, but they always look a bit engineered to me. And I think it's at the grassroots level, when people engage with each other, they do have kind of conversations about the things that matter to them. In the kind of groups you're saying, the River Nile Centre, at the Dream Stitches at Box Hill, this is kind of, you know, it's part of a normal interrelationship of how people speak, and they actually speak about things of deep meaning, and you know and we have people in our church who are persuaded by that kind of discussion to become Christians when they've not been Christians before, from whatever religious or non-religious background. So this is to me what we're, as a society, we struggle to embrace because of our long history of diffidence about our religious faith in entirety and ambiguity. But I think we need to not lose sight of the people who are in detention here in Australia. I mean, I suppose I've taken the approach when I speak to federal politicians of picking something which I think is a fairly narrow point of engagement. So I'll often speak to them about children being in detention on Nauru. And, you know, as I run into politicians now, they'll sometimes say to me, yeah, we've got to do something about getting those children out of detention. So, you know, sometimes the situation looks so big and it seems to have such a strong consensus, I think it's important to find the sharpest moral point to actually provoke the conscience and the moral awareness of people who are decision makers.
Anglican Primate and Archbishop of Melbourne, Philip Freer, with the Reverend Tim Costello of World Vision, with me, John Cleary, in Melbourne on Wednesday at the Edge Theatre, talking about refugees and the Australian conscience. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.